I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Some foods are polarizing. Green peppers, mint chocolate, pineapple on pizza, but the OG, like the one that rose from the primordial muck of love it or hate it foods, is the oyster. The author Tom Robbins once wrote that eating a raw oyster is like French kissing a mermaid, and that sounds about right to me and also sounds pretty good. But some people gag at the idea of it, they hate the slippery texture, some people love the taste of seawater, and some people, you know, they just roll their eyes at how precious and snobby the whole thing seems. Well, this week, our show is all about oysters, but while I can't promise that we can do anything for you if you don't like how they taste, I can tell you that oyster stories are far less prissy and probably way more interesting than you might have thought. Like later on, we're going to learn about the man who helped make the oyster's reputation as a classy food. We're going to get a lesson in the seagull test. And we have a story that just might make you cry. But first, we have to start in the water. Ryan and Travis Croxton are cousins and fourth-generation oystermen in the Chesapeake Bay of Virginia. Only they weren't meant to be. The last Croxton who harvested oysters was their grandfather. But when the family's leases for their oyster grounds were up, Travis and Ryan couldn't resist their family lore. They renewed those leases and tried to learn how to farm oysters. And they are here with us today. So hey, Ryan and Travis.
How's it going?
Hey, how's everything?
It's awesome to have you with us. So Ryan, when you guys first started out as oystermen, what was different about what you were doing than what, say, your great-grandfather was doing 120 years ago?
Well, the first thing that was different is we literally did not know what we were doing. So we got to start from a fresh perspective. And I'll often equate this like with the, you know, starting of our country, where you kind of got to rewrite a constitution and kind of reevaluate what everybody else was doing and then do something fresh and new that kind of took the best practices of everywhere. And that's kind of where we were. We had a system of dredging and so forth that had been our legacy that really hadn't worked for us. It basically left the bay at a point where we didn't have any oysters left. So we had to think of something new. So, you know, it started with investigating and learning how to do something different.
Mm. When you say the dredging and the legacy of it, meaning the oysters were essentially way over harvested by that point, right? By the time you started, like there weren't actually many oysters in the water anymore.
Right. So it was a wild industry that had grown in the Chesapeake Bay, and that was done through dredging the bottom. It's basically these, I'm trying to think of a good way to characterize them. They're these rakes that you drag along the bottom, and it pulls up all sorts of bycatch, and it pulls up oysters at various stages of growth. And then you kind of have to cull through it and throw everything back that you don't want. It's just a really inefficient way to do it, but it also leaves the area where you're growing oysters much worse off than you found it. Plus, you're depleting the number of oysters. You're just not putting anything back. You're not letting it rebound. So we needed to completely rethink it.
So you guys started farming oysters, which was, I think, in 2001 you started, right? This was a new idea then. Tell us what farming oysters is all about.
Well, this is Travis here. We had the history of the oyster leases, but no equipment, no land, no boats, no property. So we just had to figure out, hey, how is everyone else in the world growing oysters? And we just, at the time we were Netscaping, not Googling. looking for, on AOL, looking for how do you grow oysters, and realize that every region in the world except for the Chesapeake and the Gulf of Mexico had adopted aquaculture. And that's because they had to, because they had decimated their oyster population centuries before us. The Gulf and Chesapeake were so prolific and massive that it took more centuries to decimate that population. I mean, essentially, oh, wow. It's the Lorax story, right? I mean, mankind takes everything that it can from resources until there is no more. For us, the bay was at 1% of its historic population, and
1%.
It was a dead industry. So that's why we thought, hey, now's a good time for us to jump into business. but we thought with aquaculture, we could prove that it you could grow oysters. There were oyster gardeners that were basically some, you know, retirees that were tying up oyster floats to their docks and having success growing the native Virginica species. And so we said, well, we take that on a commercial scale. And we jumped in.
And that, yeah. And that's an important part of it, is that it was the native species, and that was a really exciting aspect to this, was we weren't just figuring out how to grow oysters, we were figuring out how to restore our native population. Because at the time, 2001, when we started getting into this, you know, they were talking about putting the eastern oyster, a moratorium on them, so putting them on the endangered species list, and possibly even introducing a Chinese oyster to replace it. So it was a... It was a scary time, because it might have meant the end of, you know, our native species.
Yeah. So, but what is farming oysters? I mean, I think most people think of oysters as the dredging you talked about. You go out, you find them, you just start digging. So farming is putting oysters back into the water?
Yeah, there are a number of ways to do it. I mean, aquaculture's thousands of years old. So, I mean, that's literally just about trying to grow product in the water. The difference about the modern age is that now we're able to actually do it in a way where we're actually adding to the wild population. So we'll take broodstock out of the water. We'll, you know, in February, warm the temperature of the water up so it kind of tricks it into thinking it's summer when it would naturally spawn. And we can create a next generation of oysters kind of out of sync with nature, which allows us to continually add oysters back to the process, which makes it a sustainable industry, versus always having to depend on the wild stock for our seed for the next year.
Oh, that's so interesting. And oysters are awesome too, because they clean the water they're in, right? So they actually improve the ecology of the bay.
Yeah, it's probably the best thing you can actually eat to improve the environment. You know, our friend Barton the Seaver has often stated, hey, if you want to save the world, eat an oyster, a farm-raised oyster. We say that our work isn't sustainable, it's restorative. Because for every oyster we sell to a restaurant, we're probably putting 12 oysters back into the water. Where we have our three major oyster farms, the wild population around them is increasing because of all the larvae that we put back into the water. The subaquatic vegetation that had been dredged up is coming back.
Oh, wow.
So, and that provides sanctuary for baby marine organisms from, you know, baby rockfish, crabs. We've had seahorses on our cages. So everything kind of comes, it's, you know, it's a full cycle, but oysters are the building block of the Chesapeake Bay and most marine ecosystems.
And there's no adding food to this. I mean, they're eating food that's ambient in the water. So, you know, unlike the, you know, a cow conversion where it's like 7 pounds of feed to get a pound of beef, you know, we're not adding any, we don't feed the animals at all. So it's the most energy efficient food source you'll find.
Yeah. And famously, oysters taste like their environment. They taste like the water you put them in. So it sounds like there can be a real level of creativity to what you do in terms of farming the oysters and playing with, you know, flavors and maybe even textures. Can you talk about that?
At its essence, we call it marroir. So we ripped off the terroir terminology from the wine industry and applied it to oysters. So oysters take on the characteristics of the marine environment where they grow, whether that's the type of strains of algae in the water, salinity, pulling some nutrients off the vegetation that's around, the minerality in the water. They take on those different characteristics. In the old days, like if you Google oyster tins Chesapeake, you'll see there were thousands of different appellations of oyster company names. Each stretch of all of the rivers had different nuances and flavors, and we had lost that. So we tried to actually bring that back. You know, early on, we went to Grand Central and noticed that they had probably 20 oysters from, 2 mile radius.
That's the Grand Central Oyster Bar, you mean?
Yeah.
In New York.
You know, yeah. So, exactly. They had, you know, 20 varieties from Massachusetts off the Cape, but they had one from the entire Chesapeake, and it was just called Chesapeake. So we wanted to kind of bring back the nomenclature from before.
The cool thing is that, I mean, the marroir effect is going to happen no matter where you grow an oyster. It's going to taste like that region. But then you know, as we evolve and as we get better at this, you start realizing that, you know, just like vintners, you start to control a lot of the process. You know what kind of exposure you obviously pick your site. You put them at different levels in the water column, which will affect their access to food and oxygen. Mm. And, you know, you can affect which type of grasses they're going to be near. You can plant different types of grasses. So there's all sorts of different ways that you can start adding layers and nuances to the oysters that are, you know, that are your own.
So, Ryan, so from 2001 till now, you know, it's almost 20 years later, what do you see? I mean, how has the world, the Chesapeake oyster, changed? I mean, I think the first documented records of people seeing the Chesapeake was that there were so many oysters, the shells were piled up almost like mountains coming out of the water. Now, in 01, when you started, you said that was essentially all gone. What are you seeing now, almost 20 years later?
Yeah, so just that arc is so fascinating. Our peak was probably like in the 1890s, where we were doing about 20 million bushels a year out of the Chesapeake Bay. In 2001, it was 21,000 bushels. Today, our company alone is doing twice as much as the entire bay did in 2001. So right now, we're doing about, I think the Chesapeake Bay is around 600,000 bushels a year that it's producing, which is the largest on the East Coast. So we've kind of gone from, you know, zero to first in a pretty short period of time. And I don't see it slowing down anytime soon. And we're still at such a fraction of the biomass that there's so much more room to go.
Cool. Let's eat some oysters. Everyone
eat
oysters.
Right? Yeah, how often can you say that, to actually go out and eat more seafood? I mean, so much of what we tell people is about restraint. But with oysters, it really is one of those things that we can encourage gluttony.
Cool. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Travis and Ryan Croxton are the owners of the Rappahannock Oyster Company on the Chesapeake Bay. And you can find a recipe for fried oysters from the terrific Southern chef, Bill Smith, on splendidtable.org.